It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore the lives of bobcats in Wisconsin ahead of the fall hunting and trapping season. According to the State Department of Natural Resources, their evasive nature leads us to think bobcats are rare, when in fact they're quite common here. Call in with a question or comment as we discuss this wildcat native to Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sean Rossler is a DNR wildlife biologist specializing in fur bearers. Sean, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me this morning.
Well, do tell us, have you seen a bobcat in the wild?
So I get this question a lot, and I want everyone to know that wildlife biologists don't always get preferential treatment from the species that we look at. So I have seen bobcat in the wild, but it is rare, and I want everyone out there to know that it is rare for them to see one as well. So if they do get that opportunity, make sure they soak it all in, because they might not have it too often.
Can you compare the size of my sweet house cat Maddie, who's 9 pounds, and compare her to the size of bobcats roaming Wisconsin?
Absolutely. So when you look at a bobcat compared to a domestic cat, you know 9 pounds, when you look at a bobcat, the average weight is somewhere between 20 and 30 pounds on average. Of course, they can be smaller than that, closer to Maddie's size, or they could be larger than that. We have some, you know, bobcats that get up to 40 pounds, so considerably larger than that. Then when you start to look at other characteristics as far as like the tail, which is an important one to look at, bobcats have a tail that's roughly, you know, 4 to 7 inches long, has a little black dot at the end, a little black dot at the tip, so telltale there as far as the overall size. And then you know, another thing that we look at with bobcat is the larger eyes, right? So they have those large eyes to allow them to see prey and things that at night, and give them those abilities during nocturnal periods.
Yeah, so the eyes, the tip of the tail, what are their markings like? Like, what might we mistake a bobcat for?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, you know, depending on geographic region, the overall coloration can change. But in Wisconsin, a lot of our bobcats, overall, the body is a tawny color. And then if you move down into the belly, it's white with black spotting. One thing I really like to point out to people, if they've asked if they've seen a bobcat, is if you look at the back of the ears, there's black, but then there's also a very distinct white blaze across the back of those ears. So that can be an indicator as well. And the other thing I just want to mention is the front legs. So if you look at the inside of the front legs, you'll see black barring. And sometimes that black barring, for other, you know, research projects, when you look at trying to identify individuals in a non-invasive way, you can, you know, tell individual based on the coloration or some of that barring or individual spotting. So those are some of the other color characteristics that we look at.
Okay, some clear distinctions there. How prevalent are bobcats in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the current status of bobcats is great, right? So bobcats are what I would consider a conservation success story. So they're doing really well, especially when you compare it to, 40 or 50 years ago. And that's not only a success story here in Wisconsin, but that's played out across the Midwest. So states to our south that didn't have bobcats now have bobcats. And if you look at their distribution, you have bobcats from, you know, Quebec all through the lower 48 down to Mexico City. So they have quite a wide distribution range here in North America.
What is contributing to that success story? Why are they coming back?
Yeah, so I think you have to look at the past to kind of understand what's going on now. So historically, we had bobcats across the landscape in Wisconsin. But just like a lot of other species, they had to deal with a few things over their history. So one of those being over-harvest in a period where didn't have regulations. You know, there was nothing to prevent harvesting more than, you know, what was sustainable. You also had habitat changes that may or may not have been beneficial to them. And then the other thing is that perceptions of people. So up and through the 1960s here in Wisconsin, we actually had programs to bounty system to incentivize harvest. And so we kind of came out of that period, where our sites changed, our philosophies changed. We started to regulate harvest. And so we've created systems now that provide bobcat protection, and along with recovery of a lot of their habitats, we've seen them expand from northern Wisconsin, where we've always had bobcats, to the south. And then we've seen bobcat populations from, the lower Midwest move north, and they've, just done a great job of recolonizing parts of their home range or historic home range.
We're talking about the resurgence of bobcats in Wisconsin. Getting a bit of that history with DNR wildlife biologist and fur bear expert Sean Rossler is here. You can join in with your questions, comments, 800-642-1234. John is here from Boaz. John, hi, what's your question?
Hi, I was going to ask if the bobcats get along with the wolves. Because both of our endangered species, and I got my money on the wolf.
All right, John, thank you. What are their interactions like, Sean?
Yeah, so I don't really look at the interactions between wolves and bobcats too often. Bobcats are not an endangered species. They're very common, found throughout the country. I suppose there are interactions. I look at interactions between, other mesocarnivores like coyotes, fox, and bobcats, and there's definitely interactions there and competition. And like John said, if there is interaction between a wolf and a bobcat, you can draw your own conclusions, but I just don't have a lot of information to share as
Sure.
far as how that would play out. I would assume, if the bobcat had the opportunity, that it would move on and avoid that conflict.
What is the life cycle like? When do bobcat moms have their litters?
Yeah, so great question. Bobcats are induced ovulators, so they could have litters throughout the year, but we generally see a similar timeline as far as reproduction as other fur bear species. So they'll breed in the late winter, early spring. They'll have their litters in the spring, and then throughout the summer, they'll be raising those kittens, and they'll have anywhere from 2 to 4. We look at it and say there's an average of 2.7, but that's kind of strange to say, because how do you have 2.7? So anywhere from 2 to 4 bobcats, and they generally stay with mom through the summer into the fall, and then we'll start to disperse like in late winter, early spring. And so one question that we get sometimes is if someone has a trail camera out and they get multiple bobcats on a trail camera, because we often talk about them being solitary. We let people know that that's more than likely, female bobcat with the young of the year.
What kind of habitat do they appreciate? What kind of habitat do bobcats need to survive?
Yeah, so I think, talking about their wide distribution throughout the country, we've had different research projects here in Wisconsin looking at, the habitat use and where they're found. Those studies have been in northern Wisconsin and southern Wisconsin, and what we find is bobcats are generalists for a large part. So as long as they can find, food and shelter, they're going to do pretty well. So we find them in a wide range of habitat types throughout Wisconsin, which I think has also helped, with that, their ability to be flexible with what they need
To
has allowed
survive.
them to, and to expand.
DNR wildlife biologist Sean Rossler specializes in fur bears as our guide to the bobcat population in Wisconsin. And you can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn about bobcats roaming Wisconsin as the hunting and trapping season gets underway this fall. According to the State Department of Natural Resources, the bobcat is our most seen member of the cat family. And we have the DNR's fur bear biologist, Sean Rossler, here. You can join the conversation. Call in with a question or comment. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring on Sean in Madison with a question. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a deer hunter in Columbia County, and this last season, I watched a bobcat chase 6 or 7 deer out of a field, and it was pretty cool to see. Just wondering if that's a normal prey species for bobcat, or if that was a different sort of interaction.
Go
ahead, Sean.
I'm sorry. Yeah, so that's a great question. When we look at the bobcat's diet, you know, a lot of times we look at it being small mammals, so cottontail rabbits, squirrels, birds, mice, voles, things like that. But it's important to point out that, you know, bobcat can be opportunistic like other mesocarnivore species, and they will prey on white-tailed deer. They will scavenge other animals too. So I wouldn't say that it's unusual to have seen that. That does occur, but I just want to point out that their diet's really broad and large and expansive and.
Well, Sean and Madison, thank you for that question. Let's go to Bruce now in Houston, Minnesota. Bruce, what's on your mind?
I have two questions. First question is, how many different subspecies of the bobcat? Because I'm in southeastern Minnesota, and I've seen, we're starting to see them in southeastern Minnesota. Are they migrating out of Missouri and up, or are we getting them out of Wisconsin and out of Canada coming down in the area? And then my last question is, when a cat gets to be over that 30-pound range, what age is that averaged cat at when he gets, let's say, 30, 35 pounds?
All right, Bruce, thank you for those questions. Sean, can you tackle them?
Yes, I think I can tackle them. So the first question that Bruce had as far as where the bobcats are coming from, I think it's an excellent question, one that we have, as fur bear biologists across the Midwest. And there's actually a project focused on that out of Luther College. So Dr. Bill Clark, working with folks at Luther College, looking at
that's in Decorah, Iowa, is that right?
Correct. Yeah. Yep. Dawn Redding, working with Dawn Redding, and all these genetic samples from bobcats have been collected from across the Midwest to have those specific genetics, and it shows a breakdown of the bobcat in northern Wisconsin being distinctive from bobcat found in the southern U.S. versus Rocky Mountain West. And so one question that we had, same as southern Minnesota, southern Wisconsin, what group of bobcats is pushing into the southern part of the state? And so we don't have that answer yet. You can hypothesize as far as what would be, is it going to be a mix, or is one going to reach that point more than the other? But they're converging on southern Wisconsin, southern Minnesota, which is really interesting to see. Hmm. And we don't have that information yet, but something that we're working on and
looking at those migration patterns. Yes.
Yep. As they're expanding their range.
And so a 30-pound bobcat, what type of age are they? What is that maturation like?
Yeah, so cannot really speak on the specific age based on the weight of an animal.
Okay.
We talk about harvest. So when a bobcat's harvested during a regulated season, we ask for a sample to be submitted. Generally that's been the carcass from the animal, but it could also just be the lower jaw. And so we gather a canine tooth from that lower jaw. And if you look at a canine tooth, there's a small portion that's sticking out above the jawline, but then it kind of goes like, what you think of maybe as a iceberg. So like 2/3 of that tooth is within the jawline. We pull that tooth out. We send it to a lab in Montana, and they're able to do a cross-section on that. And then they can count cementum annuli like rings on a tree, and give us the age of that. So that's an important part of our harvest management review and program, is to know what the age at harvest is. And so we could look at that, but right now we don't have anything like tied to a specific weight, because we're
Sure.
not gathering that at harvest, but we
What
do collect a lot.
typically is the age at harvest? What type of results do you get from Montana?
So it can be anywhere from, 1 year old to up to 12 years old. So you look back, a number of years, our age at harvest was a little bit older, but that has come down now. But we still get a range of animals, different ages that are harvested throughout the season.
Sean Rossler here as we talk about the resurgence of bobcats in Wisconsin. DNR wildlife biologist fielding your questions at 800-642-1234. Sean, looking at the hunting and trapping season for bobcats getting underway in mid-October, how competitive is the process for getting a permit?
Yeah, so I think to talk about a little bit how that process works. So there's an application period for a permit, and that application's August 1st. And so we've just passed that. We've done the drawing. And one thing that I wanted to point out is that the interest in applying for one of those permits has increased over the years. So if you look back 5 years, it was somewhere between 16 and 19,000 people that had interest in applying for a permit. And then if you look back over the last 3 years, we've gone from like 27,000 to 29,000 to 30,000 people that have applied, either for a preference point or a permit. So that interest continues to increase. We're trying to figure out, why that is. Is it because there's, more bobcat available and people see them? Or, for a while, thought it might have been related to a COVID bump. But we've seen that continue, so now we're still trying to scratch our heads and figure out why we're seeing that. But it's, I guess nice to see the interest in applying for a permit.
How does the DNR determine what's a healthy number of animals to harvest to kill?
Yeah, so we, like a lot of other species, we have a committee, a fur bearer advisory committee, and so that committee over the course of 2 days is reviewing all the best information that we have on bobcats, which is a lot because of the interest of, citizens of the state and biologists across the state as well. And so we take all that information, look through that, and then come up with a recommendation. And so the thing with permit levels or quota levels is we come up with that quota recommendation, and then that has to be approved. And then from that quota, we can then calculate our permit levels based on previous success rates. So we know that we're issuing enough permits or the right amount of permits that we're going to be pretty close to the quota that we want to reach.
What do hunters usually do with bobcats that they kill?
Yeah, so bobcats can be used for different things. So this may sound strange to some of the listeners, but bobcat is a great protein source. So we see that people will, retain the meat from those animals and use that as a protein source. Also see the fur being used, whether it's for garments or other things. And then if you look at the skull, some people will clean up the skull and use that for educational purposes or personal use as well. So a lot of times the people that are harvesting these animals are using it to the fullest potential that they can.
And since bobcats are elusive, how difficult is it to hunt them?
Yeah, so it's going to depend on the area, the person, and their experience. We definitely have success rates. Those success rates now are roughly, as an average across all zones and time periods, somewhere between 30 and 40%. So that gives you an idea of how successful, hunters and trappers are. But it's, variable across the board. Weather conditions and things like that can also come into play and influence hunter and trapper success.
How does 30 to 40% compare to other species?
So we cl collect this for, we focus in the fur bearer world, bobcat, fisher, and river otter. And so success rates for bobcat right now are currently higher than those other species. So that's an indicator too that there's, plenty of bobcat out on the landscape, and you know, people are able to find them, and you know, we really don't have any concerns related to that.
Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
Sean Rossler is a wildlife biologist specializing in fur bears with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. You can find more conversations like this one. Just navigate over to our program page at The Morning Show. Visit WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Formerly incarcerated people who struggle with opioid addictions are at high risk of overdosing when they're released from prison. In Milwaukee County, a substance abuse treatment program combines medication and drug counseling to try to reduce those risks. Evan Casey has more on how the program helped one man change his life.
5 years ago, David Stockton was strung out on heroin, homeless, and sleeping in a tent in downtown Milwaukee. Now, he's almost 1 year sober.
I'm at the point in my life where I'm doing this for me. And that's really the only way it works.
In 2011, Stockton injured his back while working. He was prescribed opioids for the pain. But soon, he was hooked. The 45-year-old Richfield native says he spent time in prison last year after he was convicted of writing bad checks to help pay for his addiction. But today, Stockton says he's sober because of a medication-assisted treatment program he started while he was still behind bars. That program is called Behind the Walls.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know where I'd be today if it wasn't for this opportunity.
The program is a public-private partnership that operates inside the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center. Stockton received drug treatment counseling as well as prescription medications that help him stay clean. One helps relieve withdrawal symptoms. Another drug that's sometimes prescribed is called naltrexone. It blocks the sedative effects of opioids. That means even if someone were to use, they wouldn't get high. Jennifer Whitwer is the director of Milwaukee County's Community Access to Recovery Services Department. She says before the program started in 2019, the prison didn't offer treatment for inmates.
The best that we could do before this program was that we would get people connected to medication-assisted treatment services the day of their release. But often, that was too late.
A 2018 study found that after release, former inmates were 40 times more likely to die of an overdose compared to someone in the general population. That's just one reason Whitwer says the program is essential.
They're in a correctional facility they can't use, and it gives people an opportunity to really reevaluate where they're at in their life and what they want their life to look like post-incarceration.
Inmates have to have a documented substance abuse disorder and volunteer for the program. When they're released, they continue their treatment at a local clinic. That's where people like Amy Malinsky with Community Medical Services come in.
Being able to get somebody started in treatment while they're already in custody and having a plan for them, an intake appointment scheduled, like everything ready to go for their day of release, we're relieving so much of that burden off of the individual.
Milwaukee's program got a large chunk of cash this year from a historic settlement with opioid manufacturers that'll help pay for it for several more years. Earlier this summer, Stockton showed visitors around the Fourth Dimension Sobriety Home.
So yeah, I mean, as you can see, this used to be a school. So we got the little jungle gym, but yeah, we've got a little bonfire area.
He's been living at the home for just over 8 months now. He came here as a resident, but now he's a manager and he takes pride in helping others. He recently helps organize a cookout with other sober living homes in the area.
Being in recovery, it's a community and we like to bring people together.
For Stockton, expanding treatment options for inmates is a matter of life and death.
With the proper guidance,
the proper motivation, the proper medication, that brought me to a place where I found my self-worth. And that goes a long way.
On Saturday, Stockton will celebrate his 46th birthday. The next day, he'll celebrate 1 year of sobriety. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the fall sports season gets underway and teams form deeper connections, we examine how social justice issues take root in student athletes. And you can join the conversation. Call in with a question or comment. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew McIntosh is Chief Program Officer for RISE. That is a national nonprofit aiming to eliminate racial discrimination, champion social justice, and improve race relations through sports. Andrew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me and having RISE on the program.
Yes, good morning. And Quentin Prince is here as well, Executive Director of the Milwaukee Youth Sports Alliance. Quentin, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Quentin, let's start with you. Your organization says sports have the ability to bring people together across racial, religious, and socioeconomic lines. What is different about youth sports that gives it that ability?
So the Milwaukee Youth Sports Alliance believes that, you know, sports is that vehicle that can essentially bring about social change, you know, by bringing coordination between stakeholders, sharing best practices, research, evaluation, and, you know, looking at the impact of sports, we feel that, you know, the sports environment really is that vehicle that can bring people together.
The vehicle that can bring people together. Andrew, turning to you, you know, sports like football can be seen as aggressive or even violent. What effect does the competitive atmosphere, the competitive nature of sports have on RISE's goals of championing social justice?
Yeah, you know, so RISE really, you know, like Quentin, really agrees that sport is that vehicle and that space that people put aside their differences. I think, you know, to your question, there's one side where there are teams, you know, schools, organizations competing against each other. But if you look within a team, you know, there are many people playing very different positions who have very different skill sets. And all of those skill sets come together to make for, you know, an effective unit. So there's a putting aside of differences, there's a working towards a common goal that I think really exemplifies the metaphor that we do want for ourselves as we build communities across the country. How can we have a common goal? How can we work towards those goals? How can we truly embrace the skill sets that each of us have to put and work towards that goal? What RISE does is really work with organizations and teams so that they recognize that, you know, even though they are competing with each other, like in football, as you mentioned, there are still, you know, a lot of similarities that exist across those teams. And so it's really about building some camaraderie, making sure that they are involved in sportsmanship, even as they, you know, work on their team towards that common goal of you know, having fun and winning.
Quentin, can you cite some examples of social justice, social good at work in youth sports here in Wisconsin?
I think one of the greatest examples is, you know, back in 2020 when our Milwaukee Bucks essentially put aside the, you know, idea of competing on the world stage and understood that they needed to take a back seat and understand that, you know, the social justice issues that were happening in the city needed to be forefront. And so for them to forego playing at the scale that they were at, to provide an opportunity for the lens to be put on these social justice issues here in Milwaukee. That's probably the largest example that I can think of right off the top of my head. But outside of the Milwaukee Bucks, we've got organizations that, you know, truly do understand that sports is that that thing that can help a community heal and grow. You know, sports is that universal language that transcends different cultures and economic barriers, you know, regardless of somebody's background. When people engage in the spectacle of sports, they find common ground. Mm-hmm. And, you know, organizations are finding that at the grassroots level to understand that, you know, these athletes that they essentially are working with have shared experiences and they come from diverse backgrounds and they can unite and celebrate their team's victories and mourn defeats and forge connections that wouldn't otherwise be possible without sports. And so I think people in Milwaukee are starting to understand just how valuable the arena of sports can be outside of just winning games.
I want to follow up on that. You mentioned 2020, after police shot Jacob Blake in Kenosha, there were teams like the Bucks and pro teams that protested, that boycotted, that wore black armbands. How might that social justice stance emerge at younger levels of play, like in high school?
I think when an organization or, teams take a stance and the community understands that this is something that needs their attention, however they decide to bring awareness to that, whether it's wearing armbands or sitting out a game, I think, you know, we really need to pay attention to when those type of things are happening. When those types of protests or whatever not happen, it's not because people essentially just want to take up arms and protest. It's because there have been compounding events that have taken place. And when, you know, athletes tend to protest, it's because their voices weren't heard before.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is their opportunity to shed light on these issues.
Sharing more of their personal journey and sharing more of their identity that hasn't been brought to light. I'm wondering, Andrew, what comes up for you and in terms of research showing how youth sports can be a catalyst for social change?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of work in the positive youth development field that talks about, you know, the assets, the skill sets that young people have that they can bring to bear to improve the circumstances in their communities, not just their own personal circumstances, but the wider circumstances of their communities. And so for us at RISE, one of the things that we think is really beneficial is allowing young people and giving them opportunities to grow that leadership. From a broad standpoint, we see it as them being more civically engaged, them really thinking about their communities and how they can utilize the resources that they have, whether it be the social capital, a lot of the psychological capital, the ideas that they have, the things that they are passionate about to bring about change. I think a lot of times, what gets covered or what gets talked about are sometimes things like protests, but young people are doing a lot in terms of initiatives that they're taking. I do know, for instance, we've worked with the Boys and Girls Club out in Denver, for instance, and they've worked on program, and they have a couple young ladies there who've been leading programming, leading community conversation, working with the Broncos to, you know, really talk about peace and initiatives around peace. There are a couple high schools in Detroit, Castec and Plymouth, which is in the suburbs, but they've been talking about the differences that exist across the team, across their backgrounds, and how they can forge stronger ties across those communities. So, you know, I think protests are part of it, but I also think young people have a ton of great ideas in terms of how we might improve our communities. Mm-hmm. And programs, you know, such as the ones we do at RISE and other sporting organizations as well, are providing them an opportunity and a platform to share some of those thoughts and ideas as well.
Andrew McIntosh is Chief Program Officer for the national nonprofit RISE. We have Quentin Prince, who leads Milwaukee Youth Sports Alliance, as we discuss the role of sports and athletes in social justice. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to tens of thousands of high school athletes. And as a new season of play begins, we examine how youth sports can be a tool for social change. Call in with your questions, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have two youth sports advocates, Andrew McIntosh from the national nonprofit Rise, and Quentin Prince is here from the Milwaukee Youth Sports Alliance. Quentin, how do you respond to families, to perhaps teachers or administrators who say sports is a place for physical activity and team building and not social justice issues? What about that sentiment of stick to sports?
So sports, yes, historically has been looked at as that competitive landscape in which you physically compete and that's all. But unfortunately, that's not the whole picture. You know, sports has long been recognized as something that has potential to inspire, something that has the ability to empower individuals. So beneath the surface of that physical competition lies, you know, a complex emotional landscape that that athletes need to navigate. And so we need to be, you know, as parents and administrators and coaches and whatnot, we need to be aware and conscious of not only are they competing on a field, but there's tons of other things that are happening beneath the surface. You know, kids bring with them, you know, to the field or court or track, you know, all kind of experiences that range across the board. And so we need to understand that there are high pressures and high expectations and societal demands that are all taking place on this field. And so if we don't address our youth holistically, we're doing them a disservice. You know, if we only focus on the idea that kids need to compete and win a game, then, you know, that's not youth development. That's not sports-based youth development. And so then what ends up happening is we have kids that, you know, aren't addressing their traumas or aren't understanding, you know, how to fully develop into themselves if we're not focusing on them holistically.
Andrew, Wisconsin Republican lawmakers recently reintroduced legislation banning transgender athletes from participating on sports teams matching their gender identity. How do you talk with students about current events happening in their state or in their community?
Yeah, I think it's really, you know, Rise really talks about starting with identity in the conversation and then recognizing that those identities translate, you know, and progress to community building and working in the community. So, you know, for us, it's really about a progression of conversations that are important, that are necessary. Rise, you know, really focuses on race and race relations in particular. But we do believe that all of the issues that face our society and face our community are things that need to be discussed. I think for a very long time, there's been a polarization around some of these conversations. But we want to create a space where we can have conversation, hear a myriad of perspectives around these things, and then find some, I think Quentin used the word common ground, find some common ground to move these things forward. You know, what we do not recommend is, you know, I guess putting issues to the side and not having a place to talk about them. We also do not feel as though adults are the only ones that can be having these conversations. These things are going to impact our young people going into the future. And so they need to be a part of the conversation. They also need to be a part of the solution for us as we move forward.
Let's bring in Steve in Cumberland. Steve, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I want to make a comment about the importance of athletics on bringing social justice into a community and resolving potentially harmful racial issues. In the city of Barron, Wisconsin, there are employment opportunities that Somali people in the Twin Cities took advantage of, and the town of Barron became highly populated by Somali immigrants to the United States, and there was a lot of racial tension around that. The principal of the high school at Barron High School noticed that a lot of the Somali boys were playing soccer in a field just on their own, and he stopped and said, would you guys be interested in playing soccer at the high school? And they started, the Somali kids started playing soccer at the high school, and it had a very positive effect of bringing the Somali population into the high school in a positive way and resolved the racial issues. And my second observation is that the same thing happened in Minneapolis at the West Bank high-rise, the Riverside Plaza high-rise, where soccer brought young, gave an opportunity for young Somali boys to become part of the community in a very positive way. And it actually...
Steve, we're short on time here, and I really appreciate you bringing this story, and I want to be able to have our guests respond to it. Andrew, you first.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a good example that Steve brings up. You know, RISE works alongside the NBA and Under Armour on a program called Building Bridges Through Basketball, where we have law enforcement come talk to the young people within their communities. And again, it's that similar goal of bringing groups that may have different perspectives around particular things to talk about the issues, build community and move forward. So yes, so there are several examples, I think. I'm glad that Steve highlighted a couple of them that show that sport can bring us together, allow us to deal with real issues facing our communities, and move forward.
Quentin, what do you want to point out about such a story like that?
Well, one, I want to thank the caller for sharing that story. That I'd love to hear stories like that, because that is an example of communities understanding the power of sport. And it makes me think about a quote from Nelson Mandela that he said probably like 22 years ago at the start of like the Invictus Games. He said that, you know, sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to unite people in a way that little else does. You know, it speaks to youth in a language that they understand. I think that, well, one, that quote is extremely powerful, and I use that often, and it essentially what we heard in that caller's story is that power of sport that Nelson Mandela was speaking about.
Well, Quentin and Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Quentin Prince is Executive Director of Milwaukee Youth Sports Alliance. Andrew McIntosh is Chief Program Officer for RISE, that is a national nonprofit that aims to eliminate racial discrimination, champion social justice, and improve race relations through sports. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.